its infancy. It's kind of evolving, I guess. This is the first. Yeah. So, you know, bring the beignets in. What better than having beignets and listening to lectures? Right. I know, we just ate lunch at Emerald, so it probably didn't help matters. It was good. Got full. Who may start, Jim? Jim, do you want me to go ahead and start? Oh, okay. No, that's fine. So I'm a clinician, like I said earlier, and so I tend to look at stuff more from a clinical aspect than a purely research aspect. And I live in Indiana in the Midwest, so we see a lot of obesity, and I see a ton of heel pain, as Pat Moore can attest to. She's in Indiana also. So it's a really common problem. So I just thought, what does the literature have to say about the interplay between these two things? And is there any literature regarding it? And what can we learn from that literature? So obesity's probably the greatest cause of preventable morbidity and mortality worldwide. And we know that weight loss associated with reductions is associated with reductions in risk of both morbidity and mortality. So, you know, obese patients who lose weight become healthier and they are less drained on the system overall. So our goal is to try to promote weight loss when we can for the obesity problem that we have. And if you start to look at some of the numbers, worldwide, this is just a map showing some of the obesity rates worldwide, and you can see the U.S. falls in that 30 to 35% range. This is kind of a busy chart, but on the left is obesity. On the right is just what's considered overweight. So and those numbers, unfortunately, are rising year by year, not just in the United States, but worldwide, and it's an epidemic for sure. Evidence from systematic reviews suggests that long-term weight loss is possible through changes in both eating and physical activity. So getting people moving is critical to losing weight. But we also know that weight loss from behavioral interventions typically peaks around 6 months into the weight loss program, and then most people tend to regain their weight after that six-month period. So that's sort of the depressing news about it. Maintenance of weight loss is crucial to uphold the health benefits, and understanding how to best support people in sustaining weight loss is paramount to controlling the obesity epidemic and its consequences. So, you know, if we can get past that six-month hurdle and then keep people losing weight to get to their ideal body weight, they can then benefit from their improved health. But if we don't keep them physically active, then they're going to go backwards, is really the bottom line. So let's talk about some of the gait-related changes due to obesity. Literature says, you know, people who are obese have shorter steps. They take a shorter step. They have a slower gait pattern. They have increased step width. Greater ankle joint dorsiflexion, less plantar flexion, increased Q angle at the hip, increased hip abduction angle, significantly more abducted foot angles, increased out-toeing, and they're more flat-footed, especially in early stance phase. There's an article in Foot and Ankle International where they looked at foot and ankle orthopedic clinics, and they looked at obesity and foot-related problems. They had almost 1,400-plus patients in the study. And you can see the breakdown of male to female, slightly more female than male. They used a BMI per the World Health Organization standard, so normal is 18.5 to 24.9, and overweight or obese BMIs were considered greater than 25. And you can see the breakdown is about 50-50. So they did a logistic regression comparison of BMI to plantar fasciitis and demonstrated that patients who were obese had 1.4 times increased probability of developing plantar fasciitis. They also looked at tendonitis. It was about twice as much. And then also osteoarthritis was about 1.5 times as much. So obese patients are definitely more at risk for developing foot conditions than non-obese patients. This is just a chart showing a breakdown of their overall
diagnoses. You can see plantar fasciitis is relatively high. I definitely see more plantar fasciitis in my regular office than I do tendonitis or problems like that, but I've had a lot of stress fractures too. But maybe that's just because it's a foot and ankle orthopedic clinic versus a podiatric clinic. That might be a difference, but by far the most common thing I see in my office is plantar fasciitis.
So here's the breakdown. You can see their total sample, foot pain, no foot pain patients. BMI was 35 for the foot pain, plus or minus 7.8. No foot pain was 28. So, you know, they were considered normal weight. They also looked at the total fat mass, the total skeletal muscle mass. The FMI is the fat mass index, and then the FFMI is the free fat-free mass index, so it's taking fat out of the picture. And you can see the clinical relevance for BMI, total fat mass, and then the fat mass index were all statistically significant numbers in regards to comparing the foot pain to no foot pain groups. When they looked at the univariate or multivariate comparison, again, BMI, total fat mass, and FMI, for the univariate factors and the multivariate factors was just the BMI. Another thing they looked at in the study was what type of fat was it? Was it android fat, which is basically stomach fat, or genoid fat, which is the hips, more weight in the hips? And then they looked at relationships to total body fat and then comparisons to those the trunk or the extremities. The p-value was statistically significant for percent of total body fat in both the univariate and multivariate. And then also the android genoid body fat had lower incidence of foot pain than patients who had android body fat. So the sort of summarization of that was how it affected the center of pressure being on the stomach versus the hips and what that related to as far as transference of weight through the foot. For every 1% increase in android fat, the odds of foot pain were increased by 1.42. In contrast, increase in genoid total body fat ratio was a 1% decrease, or a decrease by 1% increase, decreased the foot pain odds ratio by 0.83. This is sort of a summarization of their article that I thought was interesting. The fact that the association of fat mass and foot pain remained significant after adjusting for skeletal muscle mass suggests that the mechanism of action may not simply be via loading of the joints, but an increase in the adipose mass may also have a systemic effect contributing to foot pain. And I understand that, but it doesn't logically make sense to me. I don't know about anybody else here, but more weight on the foot has got to have a biomechanical effect on the foot in a bad way. Their study demonstrated that in addition to fat mass being positively associated with foot pain, a similar association was also seen between the FMI and foot pain, but not the FFMI, which further supports the notion that obesity impacts foot pain through a more systemic rather than biomechanical effect, and that this is independent of height. But then they go on to say this, and I think this gets back to the biomechanics. Nonetheless, we cannot rule out potential involvement of biomechanical mechanisms since it is possible that carrying excess load in the abdomen region versus the genoid region may affect a person's stance or gait and thus load the foot differently, producing a detrimental biomechanical environment. I just think inherently there has to be a biomechanical environment effect by having increased weight, whether it's in the abdomen or in the hips. There's a study also that looked at chronic plantar heel pain. First, chronic plantar heel pain affects about 15% of all adult foot complaints. requiring professional care are due to chronic plantar heel pain. There are intrinsic etiologies and extrinsic etiologies for chronic plantar heel pain. Some of the intrinsic etiologies we know sort of inherently, decreased ankle joint dorsiflexion, limb length inequality, increased plantar fascia thickness, excessive pronation, older age, increased BMI have been reported. Extrinsic etiologies, standing, shoe foot, previous injury, runners, and that's depending on the surface they're on, the speed, the frequency, the distance per week. So all those are factors, both intrinsically and extrinsically, for chronic plantar heel pain. However, this is all empirical evidence, and most of these factors, there's no significant evidence-based medicine for any of these, really. So this article from the British Journal of Musculoskeletal Disorders in 2007, they had a case group where they had 80 patients. They looked at bilateral chronic heel pain. The range of age was 20 to 82, the mean of 52. You can see the female to male breakdown. Their duration of symptoms were 6 to 96 months. Has anybody here ever had heel pain? I have. I couldn't imagine having it for 96 months. That would be awful. So 12 months was the mean. In their control group, they also had 80 patients, and each were individually age-matched within 2 years and sex-matched. And they had no history of chronic plantar heel pain. So they had a case group and a control group of the same number. They used the foot posture index, which a lot of foreign articles seem to use. It's basically a 6-point weight-bearing exam, and there's a 5-point scale, which ranges from +2 to -2. And basically, a negative 12 is a highly supinated foot, and a positive 12 is a highly pronated foot. They looked at BMI. They also looked at ankle joint range of motion. This is where I have a bit of a problem with the article. They use a dorsiflexion lunge test, which is pictures from their article. And they put an inclined meter on the back of the leg to measure the dorsiflexion. There's a lot of problems with that if you know anything about the dorsiflexion lunge test. They also use occupational rating scale to evaluate the stress placed on the lower extremity during a typical work day. It's a 60-point scale. So, you know, is truly working in a factory wearing steel-toed boots a contributing factor to heel pain or not? That's what that scale kind of gave them the information on. The other thing they looked at was a standing heel raise test to check for calf endurance, and this is how they did the test, showing the picture there, and until the patient could max out on their heel raises. What they found is basically the pronated foot structure, which ranged with a foot position index of 4 to 10. Chronic plantar heel pain was 3.7 times more likely to have a pronated foot structure greater than 4. And basically the theory was increased strain on the plantar fascia, which is something that I think we definitely all see every day, and it makes sense logically. BMI, chronic plantar heel pain patients were 2.9 times more likely to be obese, greater than 30. There's an increased risk factor, basically because of increased vertical of forces and internal stress on the plantar heel area. The ankle joint dorsiflexion lunge test, the case group was 7.1, the control group was 6.6 degrees. The p-value is less than 0.001. They did question equinus as a causative risk for chronic plantar heel pain. They found that actually increased ankle joint dorsiflexion may be more of a risk factor for chronic plantar heel pain. But my argument, because there is a lot of literature that talks about the relationship between equinus and chronic plantar heel pain, is the test that they use, the lunge test. I don't think that's a very reliable factor because, first, you're getting all kinds of dorsiflexion through the midfoot, the subtalar joint, you're not getting straight ankle joint range of motion. I don't think it's necessarily an accurate measurement. Calf endurance, decreased calf endurance was not a risk factor for chronic plantar heel pain. So not having a super strong calf was not a big factor. As far as prolonged standing, that's what the occupational rating scale was used for. There's no association found between chronic plantar heel pain and average time spent sitting, standing, walking on uneven ground, squatting, climbing, lifting, carrying, or total stress placed on the lower extremity. So that was not a factor. So basically their conclusion was obesity and the pronated foot posture were associated with chronic plantar heel pain and may be risk factors for the development of the condition. Decreased ankle joint dorsiflexion, calf endurance, and occupational lower limb stress did not appear to have a role. To initiate our, basically, what is our goal when we're treating these patients? So you have a patient that comes in that has heel pain and they're obese. What's our goal? What are we trying to accomplish besides getting their heel pain better? We want to initiate or continue an exercise regime that will allow them to continue to lose weight or start losing weight and maintain the weight loss long term, because let's face it, if they lose weight, their heel's probably going to get better also. Some questions I think we have to address when we have an obese patient with chronic plantar heel pain is, should treatment be more aggressive to resolve the condition as quick as possible? Are we more aggressive with our treatment? And if so, how does an aggressive, rapid result treatment plan correlate to established treatment protocols? Do we change our established treatment protocols at all? And what and when is the role of surgical intervention? And how can we promote exercising with a painful heel? Because if you've had a heel that's been painful and you try to exercise, it's no fun. It's very easy to say, you know, I'm not going to go out for that walk because my heel hurts. And that's the worst thing they can do, is not go out for that walk. And then what's our role in obesity counseling and treatment? I mean, do we play a role in that? Should we start taking some ownership in counseling? The bottom line is, a patient that's obese knows they're obese. I mean, we worry about making them feel bad by telling them that you need to lose weight, but I mean, at what point do we have to start doing that? And then what is the role of weight loss in chronic plantar heel pain? If you've ever had any patients that have had heel pain and have gone through a substantial weight loss, either through bariatric surgery or whatever, quickly, it's amazing how much better they get and how quickly. It makes a big difference. So what are my opinions? I think their obesity and chronic plantar heel pain are definitely interrelated. You have to have a comprehensive podiatric history and physical exam, including a biomechanical exam, when you're evaluating these patients. There has to be honest, compassionate patient education. And you have to have an honest discussion about their heel pain and that, yes, your weight is part of the problem, and we need to do something about it. And you have to promote exercise, and the studies are clear that weight-bearing exercises are more beneficial to losing weight than non-weight-bearing exercises. So, yes, it's easier to ride a bike than go out and run because you're not burning as many calories per mile or whatever. Our primary challenge as a treating physician is aggressive therapy that leads to rapid resolution. We know through studies that conservative treatment should work more than 80% of the time for heel pain. What I use is a two-step treatment plan, and I base it on the pain scale. So I really monitor the pain scale, how the patient is doing on the pain scale. The acute condition treatment, it's a comprehensive treatment of the etiologies and symptoms until you see resolution of pain. And for me, that means treating the equinus if they have it, and the literature is clear, 80% of the time they usually have equinus. Treating the biomechanical components, the pronation. You can see plantar fasciitis in a supinated foot too for different reasons. But you have to address those biomechanical reasons, whatever they are. And you want to treat those at the same time as you're treating the symptoms of inflammation. So just to give somebody a shot and treat the symptoms without treating the causes makes no sense to me. So I think if you treat the etiology simultaneously with the symptoms, you'll get rapid resolution of their problem. And then the long-term treatment is prevention of recurrence. And that's where I think orthotics come into play. I think orthotics are more of a long-term treatment in conjunction with stretching. I think stretching is... The literature is clear to stretch somebody out, you have to stretch for at least 6 weeks duration. I think it's more like 8 to 12 weeks to get somebody's calf muscle stretched out. So it's part of the initial and the long term. So what about surgery? You have to tread lightly, I think, with surgery with an obese patient heel pain, chronic plantar heel pain. Currently, the recommendation in most studies is 6 months of conservative therapy before you consider surgical intervention. Well, I think we have to look at that, and I don't think we can be that dogmatic about a timeline. It has to be more individualized. What's the patient's needs? Is this patient trying to lose weight and they're not being able to exercise because their heel's sore? Everything you're doing is not working. do we need to make that decision sooner or not? And I think that's individualized. And I think that's a paradigm that has to be reevaluated, especially in this type of patient. I'm not saying you have to take patients to surgery after 2 weeks of conservative care, but you have to take the whole big picture into consideration. What's the patient's goals? Where are they? Have they progressed at all on the pain scale reduction? You know, where are they in the overall big picture of things, and have a discussion with them about what's going to be the best choice for them. Before I do surgery on anybody for heel pain now, I get an MRI to evaluate for Baxter's neuritis. I think that that's a common cause of non-resolving chronic plantar heel pain. So, and that's a diagnosis based on MRI, so it's worth it to know that, to have that knowledge before you make the decision of surgery, because that does alter what you do surgically if they do have it. So I get an MRI. I have gone to avoiding, at all cost, cutting the plantar fascia. I'm still probably the only one in our state that's not cutting the plantar fascia for heel pain that goes to surgery. I lecture all the time to our state and other people about trying to not cut the plantar fascia. Because when you cut the plantar fascia, the studies are clear you're weakening foot biomechanics. And if you take that into consideration on an obese patient that already has poor biomechanics, you know, what are you doing to them long term? Sure, short term you're helping their heel pain. What's the long term resolution long term consequence going to be of cutting their plantar fascia? I think it's going to be devastating for their foot function. Instead of taking that approach, I think we need to reconsider, and there's been three studies that talk about just doing a gastrocnemius recession and not touching the plantar fascia. When you lengthen the gastroc, you actually improve foot function and foot biomechanics, as opposed to weakening it. And all the studies have had about 80% success rates by doing a gastroc recession and not touching the heel. The thing about that is that it requires a discussion with the patient. You have to explain, okay, I'm going to go up in your calf and cut your calf muscle. I'm not going to touch your heel. There's a 20% chance or so that this may not work. It's going to take 8 weeks for your heel pain to resolve, but you know what? It's worth it. There's a small chance when you have to go back and do a plantar fascia release, but it's worth that chance to not cut your plantar fascia. So I have that discussion with every patient I do, and I've been doing this for about 2 to 3 years now, and I'm a clinician, I'm not a researcher, so I don't keep a lot of hard stats. But I would say my just anecdotal findings are in line with what the studies show, about 80% success rates. I do a Bowman procedure, a medial calf approach. You're doing an intramuscular lengthening versus an aponeurotic lengthening, so you don't get the weakness, you don't get the scarring problem. It's just a much better approach. It's a great procedure. It's one of my favorite surgeries to do. Because I do it if I'm doing a Lapidus, I do it if I'm doing a flat foot reconstruction. I do a lot of those in conjunction with other procedures, but I also will do them for heel pain, and that's the only thing that I am doing for heel pain. I think we have to consult the patient's primary care physician to develop a comprehensive care plan for their obesity and their chronic plantar heel pain. So don't be afraid to pick up the phone and call Dr. Smith and say, I've got Mary Jones in. I'm treating her for heel pain. But obesity is part of it. What can we do to help manage her obesity? I'm sure that they have tried, but I think when you start collaborating, you can get some more headway. And I think you have to consider a referral to a dietitian or nutritionist to get the patient some education. And even a bariatric referral, if indicated. Or a referral to a personal trainer. The patient says, hey, I don't know how to exercise. I don't know what I should be doing. A personal trainer that's highly recommended. I work with the Pacers. I've been their team doctor for a long time, so they have tons of trainers that work with their players. So I know who is a good trainer who will actually help a patient lose weight. So I can say, well, I know this guy, he works with the Pacers, and I think he's taking clients on. So that can be beneficial. What about a psychiatric referral? Sometimes eating's more than, there's a psychiatric component to sometimes with food. So that's another consideration to me. That's all I have. Any questions? Thank you.
Just one quick question, Liz. On that one point that stated that a pronated weight is 3 times, 1.7 times more likely for a chronic plantar fascia pain. Is that for both the congenital and acquired, or is it just
all the patients in that study were adults. They didn't differentiate that. Okay. But that, in my mind, brings up, like I said, I see a lot of kids too, that brings up the age-old question, you know, would it fit with a flat foot that's asymptomatic and not treated? Well, you know that what's going to happen down the line if you don't. So, I mean, I'm not saying you have to do a reconstructive surgery on a kid that's asymptomatic with a flat foot, but, you know, maybe they should be in orthotics, and they should be stretching their calf. Because if they don't, they're going to end up have a higher incidence of chronic left heel pain, arch pain, things like that down the line. So.
I think I discovered it because I'm related to pain.
Any other questions? Stop cutting the counter fascia. I mean, in this patient, it can be devastating. It can make things worse.